Members, I'd like to bring the Environment, Energy, Natural Resources, Policy, Finance Committee to order. We're going to concentrate today and tomorrow on the middle words in our Committee on Energy. First up is House File. The plan is, members, we'll see how things go. If possible, we should be able to get through these bills this morning, especially I think Representative Hackbart's going to chair most of the meeting when he gets here. It may even go a little faster than we're used to. So, but we're reserved back here at 4:30 with the thought that we could come back between 4:30 and 6 if the need arises, and still in time for folks to get the different things going on tonight. So, Representative Anderson, you have House File 1212. If you want to come before us and move that bill, that would be terrific.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everybody, committee members. I have a delete all amendment, the DE2 amendment. Has that been passed around?
Representative Anderson, why don't you move your bill first?
I would move House File 1212.
For possible inclusion in what we'll call an omnibus energy bill at this point in time, members. All the bills today will be heard with the idea that when we come back after Easter, we'll put them together in an energy bill. So, Representative Anderson, to your amendment. Or if you want to move your, is it a DE amendment?
I would move the DE2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Members, Representative, do we have a quorum? Representative Anderson would like to move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape he'd like. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay? Okay, motion carries. Representative Anderson, you have your bill like you like it now, if you could explain it.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This was brought to me by one of the cities in my district, of the city of Melrose. They have a public utilities commission with their own utility run by the city. And about half the cities in the state have increased the size of their commissions because of the business expanding, getting bigger. And they would like to address open meeting law concerns. Currently, it's a three-person board, and if two members would get together at a coffee shop, whatever, why, that could be a possible open meeting law violation. So they would like the flexibility to increase their board up to a maximum of seven members that would be set by the city by ordinance and statute. And I would ask for the members' support of this amendment.
Thank you. We have adopted that amendment, Representative Torkelson, so the bill is in the shape that you'd like. Is there discussion to the bill? Okay. Representative Anderson, we'll lay your bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus energy bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Next, Representative Hilty, I think you've got a series of them, and maybe we'll, I think it starts with House File 1433. I think there's some different agency bills. Did I see Mr. Grant? Oh, yeah. And good morning, Representative Hilty.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
I think we're on the same schedule, Representative Hilty. We'll lay them over, so we'll do them one at a time.
Very good, Mr. Chair. I would then move House File 1433 for inclusion in possible omnibus bill. House File 1433 is a number of changes to current law that basically are things that are obsolete or no longer relevant to current situation. As you see, we have the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce and Director of the Office of Energy Security here, who I presume will explain the necessity for the changes in this bill.
Mr. Chairman and members, Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce, Office of Energy Security. Representative Hilty is correct. This is technical language cleaning up some outdated language in statute relative to the weatherization program. Basically, there are two things going on here on the first page. There's deletion of language relative to software being developed by the Department of Education. Language that we find no longer necessary, and I have the program manager here if you'd like a further explanation. And then on the second page, at the bottom of the page, the deletion of the rules requirement. Since we follow the DOE federal weatherization program, there's no need for state-level rulemaking authority in this area. So those are the principal changes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Questions?
Thank you. We'll lay House File 1432 over for possible inclusion. 1433. And we're going to move to 1432. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1432 also for possible inclusion, and that's a bill that would eliminate the requirement for the compilation of information that my understanding is not really used in any case, and Director Grant can explain that further.
Mr. Chairman and members, again, Mr. Hilty, or Representative Hilty is correct. The language on page 2, beginning at 2.2, that's deleted is information that we collect but are never asked for. It's also information that is collected by the Public Utilities Commission, and so there's some redundancy there, and we feel that it's more appropriate for the commission to collect this information since they're the ones that administer the cold weather rule. So this is, again, is a technical change.
Okay. Any questions, Representative Beard?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Grant, thank you for bringing this forward. I have a hunch there's a whole pile of these reports over there that we collect that few people, if anybody, actually look for them. So I think this is one we should embrace enthusiastically, and if you find more, let this member encourage you to bring more of these bills forward. I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Any additional questions? Seeing none, we'll lay House File 1432 over for possible inclusion and move on to House File 1431. Representative Hilty.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1431 for possible inclusion as well. What this bill does is basically eliminate the requirement for transmission project report on the part of certain independent power producers that my understanding is have little or nothing to do with the overall planning of transmission in any case, and this would relieve them of the responsibility of that biennial report.
And Mr. Chairman, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's exactly what this does.
Additional questions? Okay. Any comment on the department bill from anybody in the audience, from the public, from the department bills? Okay, thank you, Mr. Representative Hilty and Commissioner Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we'll move on to Representative Beard, House File 1082.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I'd like to move House File 618, and we'll
618?
I'm sorry, we're on 1082.
1082.
Yes, 1082, the cold weather reporting rule, and lay it over for possible inclusion. And I do have a one-word author's amendment that's recommended by our friends at Xcel Energy. Actually, it's more than one word, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Eloff, ready for
Mr. Eloff,
amendment?
Do you have the amendment?
I'll read it to the committee, but I think Mr. Eloff probably created this amendment, if I'm not mistaken.
Representative Beard.
On line 1.9, strike the word electronically so that it reads by first class mail, comma, or electronically for those requesting electronic billing, comma, and then the rest of the bill, sentence. Mr. Eloff, do you have
Mr.
that?
Eloff.
Mr. Chair, just one addition to that. The word or on line 1.9 should also be stricken.
Correct. Electronically, comma, or. Should strike those. So read by first class mail, comma, or electronically for those requesting electronic billing. Mr. Chairman, if I have a written copy for Mr. Eloff, but if I just have the page, take that up to him.
Everybody understand the amendment?
Luke, you want to run this?
All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chairman, 1082 makes a small change to the cold weather rule by allowing the cold weather rule notification to be made electronically. The amendment is actually suggested by our friends at OES, and it clarifies that electronic notification may only be made for customers who've opted for electronic billing, such as my household. And I know many people are going to electronic billing these days, and so this would allow electronic billing to be applied. This bill would apply to all investor-owned utilities and everyone who applies to the cold weather rule. It would save Xcel Energy alone about $70,000 a year in postage. We expect the savings to increase as more customers take advantage of online billing. The language is amended, has been okayed by OES, the PUC, and as well as the other folks in the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities, and our friends at Energy Sense Coalition, which represent a lot of the low-income customers. So that's the bill, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to stand for questions if necessary or call a testifier if you think you need to hear one.
Members, any questions? Representative Beard? Representative Hilde.
Mr. Chair, I would just say that I was aware that there were some concerns about the language in this bill that I think that the amendment does rectify. So I don't see any problems with it at this point.
Very good. Anyone else? Anyone from the audience need to testify or have any comments? No further testimony, Mr. Beard? Representative Beard?
Mr. Chairman, no. No other testimony. Thank you.
Okay, we'll lay House File 1082 over for possible inclusion and move on to House File 618. Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 618. We'll lay that over for possible inclusion as well. Thank you.
Okay.
And I know that, Mr. Chairman, the pages have some handouts and there are some testifiers that are coming to talk about this bill as well. If you'll pardon me for just a moment, I'm going to walk over and pick up an agenda which has the list of testifiers on it.
And Representative Beard, should we take the amendment to get it in the shape that you'd like?
I do. In your packets, members, there is a DE1 amendment that skinnies up the bill quite a bit and clarifies some issues and takes some things that were causing a little angst off the table, or just clarifies that there's certain things not applying.
Representative Beard moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he'd like. All in favor of that signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Representative Beard, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill basically does just a couple things. It, as you'll remember, back in the discussion days of 2003, when we had the Prairie Island reauthorization or dry cast storage expansion question before us, there was several large energy issues swirling around at the time, and one that I was handed, probably because of my familiarity with coal mining, growing up in the coal fields of Western Pennsylvania, and having had family experience working in electrical generation, both wind and coal powered. The Speaker handed me this little bill, become known as the Excelsior Energy Bill, one that I've become a champion of over the years, and they've done a job, I think, of negotiating the environmental permitting and maze, and have come to this point today now where there apparently is going to be an opportunity presenting itself for some electrical generation, but immediately will be gas fired instead of IGCC fired. Coal gasification fired. Because of some things at the federal level beyond our control, the project hasn't moved as fast as we thought it would back in 2003. But those of us that deal with the federal government on a regular basis understand how that is. So this would merely extend for a short period of time the everything that accrued to the site for an innovative energy generating facility, and would extend it to a startup phase, which is intended to be a bridge to the coal gasification innovative facility from now until that time. Mr. Chairman, with that, I think there are some people that can speak a little more eloquently and technically for some elucidation and to be able to stand for questions better than I could, so I'd like to call a test buyer's report, if I may.
Very good. Excelsior Energy, Julie Jorgensen, Tom Ostroff. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Good morning. I'm Julie Jorgensen, co-CEO and president of Excelsior Energy. And I'd like to just provide you very briefly with the background on the history of the permitting of the project to date. And then our general counsel, Tom Ostroff, will walk you through in more detail what this bill does for that permitting process going forward. We've been developing, as Representative Beard said, an IGCC plant since 2001. In 2003, we passed enabling legislation here in Minnesota, and the U.S. Department of Energy selected the project in a competitive solicitation for co-development. It has overall, I would say, been an effective public-private partnership to overcome some of the obstacles that are presented when you try to introduce an innovative technology, especially in a large project. And very briefly, IGCC, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is coal gasification, where the plant basically has two islands. One converts coal to a gas that can be cleaned up of impurities prior to combustion, resulting in much cleaner power generation than if a typical coal plant where you combust the coal directly and then try to clean the emissions that are coming out of the stack. I believe one of the handouts shows the dramatic emission reduction achieved by the technology as compared to the three plants in Wisconsin and South Dakota that have been most recently permitted, basically 10 to 80% reductions on criteria pollutants, NOx, SOx, and PM2.5, and a 75 to 85% reduction on mercury emissions, so very clean, emission profile. The project has hit its share of bumps in the road. I don't have to remind anyone that we're in the largest recession of any of our lives. During the development of the project, shale gas, non-conventional natural gas derived from fracking shale, has come to the fore. There's been a glut in natural gas, and so it's at this time cheaper than coal, but I'd like to remind the committee that in the 10-year period we've been developing the project, that's been the case and then not been the case. The problem with making power plant decisions is we tend to make them based on current market conditions, and you're making a 40-year decision. But rather than fight that fact, we've decided to propose something that's unique to IGCC, is that you can build the gas-fired generation that's fueled just by natural gas separately from the coal gasification facilities that make the gas that you use in the natural gas combined cycle power plant. So the proposal today is we've got a site that was commissioned and approved by the Public Utilities Commission for 1,200 megawatts of IGCC generation, which is basically two utility scale units of IGCC, and the proposal is to continue permitting the first unit, which is the DOE project, as an IGCC unit, and get that to completion, get our final state permits issued there, and then at the same time permit the Unit 2 site, as we call it, so that it can start out just with natural gas fired generation, and then we could add the gasification facilities, which could either come in the form of retrofitting the IGCC plant, if that's more cost effective, or just building gasification facilities on a standalone basis on the site. The other thing we're waiting out is that EPA and Congress are battling out whether EPA has the right to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and there's been a lot of uncertainty about and decision making surrounding that battle that's ongoing. So this would also give the state, you know, a chance to see how that comes out and see if there's a price on carbon and where natural gas and coal come out, given that price. One of the benefits of natural gas is that it's more flexible to back up the wind, and since we have added a significant amount of wind generation since 2001 when we started developing the project, that's sort of a change of circumstance. Our key milestones to date, there's a handout that has, I won't go into the detail, that has our basically our permitting milestones, but basically in October of 2005, we started preparing the draft environmental impact statement. 2 years later, the draft environmental impact statement was issued. Throughout the period, there have been numerous public hearings with administrative law judges. We've sought comments and received comments from a dozen state agencies. More than 700 comments were addressed. And then 2 years after the draft EIS was issued in 2007, the final EIS was issued in November of 2009. Following that, the Minnesota PUC issued the site and route permits in March of 2010. And since then, what's basically left is the, you know, this is a joint state and federal permitting process. So this lays the groundwork for the issuance of the permits at the state level. But as this process draws out, as everything takes longer than it used to take, a lot of the protocols and rules change while you're in the process of getting your site permit. So now we're back finishing our air modeling protocols and different things with the state agencies, but coming to a point where those state permits should be close to becoming ready to be issued. You know, just quickly going to my, I guess, takeaway points, this project has demonstrated the extreme difficulty of permitting even the cleanest forms of generation in the U.S. and particularly, I would say, in Minnesota. And if it takes 5+ years to license a site and then 5 years to conduct the final engineering and construct a baseload facility, we believe that having a fully permitted in-state option, a site option to meet load growth is critical to the state's energy security. There are many potential sources of new demand for electricity in the state. The drop-off in industrial demand that was experienced during the recession masks the fact that underlying load growth is still occurring. EPA's new regulation on existing coal plants put thousands of megawatts of aging coal capacity in our region in jeopardy. The recent tragic events in Japan make new nuclear capacity a very difficult proposition, in addition to the burden of additional scrutiny that will be placed on existing units. Municipal utilities in the state, which have been given notice by local utilities that they're cutting off service, have banded together and issued an RFP to meet their needs. And there are several potential new industries on the Iron Range that will require many hundreds of megawatts of new capacity that's not included in any utilities resource plan for the coming horizon. So this bill helps keep alive two strong options for new power generating capacity that are within the state's borders. And now I'll have Tom walk you briefly through the bill.
Tom Beard. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce our legal counsel and the technical expert, Tom Osterhaus from Excelsior Energy Company. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Tom Osterhaus, O-S-T-E-R-A-A-S, and I'm the general counsel at Excelsior. As Representative Beard indicated, the Delete All Amendment is an attempt to shorten and simplify the proposed bill. Walking you through it, what we've proposed is adding a new Subdivision 3 that would contemplate staging of the integrated plant, which is what Julie mentioned a moment ago, where you would build the combined cycle natural gas plant first, and then you'd have it on a site that you know could accommodate later conversion to coal if and when it became economic to do so. So Subdivision 3, Paragraph A, clarifies that the current existing exemption from the certificate of need for 1,200 megawatts of coal would also apply to the staged gas plant that you would build. And I would note, from a broader public policy perspective, this notion is consistent with current law in that under the current Certificate of Need statute, there's already an exemption for conversions of existing facilities to operating on natural gas. So in a sense, you know, our existing facility is the proposed integrated coal gasification facility, and what we're suggesting here is that by staging it, we would convert it to natural gas, which under the current Certificate of Need law is already exempt from the Certificate of Need process. Paragraph B then goes on to talk about the permitting and clarifies under B1 that the permits that we've obtained for sites and routes after about 5 years of effort for the integrated coal plant would also be deemed valid for the natural gas staged plant. Recall that even though the coal plant is remarkably clean, as Julie mentioned, a natural gas plant would have even lower emissions, and therefore it's sensible if the site has already been certified to accommodate 1,200 megawatts of coal, we know that it can accommodate natural gas generation. And then the second paragraph, under paragraph 2, B2, is acknowledging the fact that we've been through this long contested case proceeding and addressed, as Julie mentioned, over 700 comments that various people filed, and therefore the air and water and other state pre-construction permits for the integrated plant would not be subject to additional contested case hearings. So that's the bill. It doesn't expand any of the, I think when the initial bill was introduced, there was some confusion because there are other regulatory incentives in the current law. And what the introduced bill said and what we've confirmed here is that we're not intending to expand any of the other regulatory incentives to the staged plant. It's simply the ones that are identified here, and there's no other changes. There's no mandates. There's no funding requirement. It's simply allowing the project to move forward with permitting on the first increment, which is the natural gas combined cycle plant. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Beard, any additional comments? We've been moving along really well up to this point, and
certainly,
yeah, there's quite a change in this bill, so I think it's important that we get these changes understood. So, any questions from members?
I will.
Representative Palm?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a clarification on, I did notice you've got a note in here, natural gas route permit. What is the capacity that you've got in the present gas line, and then what are you looking at it? One additional line, and what time frame for buildings?
Thank you, Representative. The capacity of the currently permitted gas line would be sufficient to serve the stage plant, so there'd be no change in the currently proposed gas line.
Very good. Representative Fault.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for walking in a few minutes late, so maybe this has been covered, but to the testifiers, anybody want this power? Besides for the people proposing it, I mean, is there any utility that wants to purchase it?
Thank you, Representative. I think you've asked sort of a broader question about whether there's going to be a need for new capacity in Minnesota going forward, which we believe very strongly there is and will be. And so what we're trying to do is preserve options for the state and sort of tee up alternatives that don't currently exist so that if and when the regulatory regime might change, we are ready to move quickly to address, you know, any reliability concerns that might exist that people aren't currently anticipating. I mean, the EPA regulations, for instance, as currently proposed, would impose very strict limits on existing generation in the 2015 timeframe. And if those would go forward, that could present problems for the state. And so all we're trying to do here is preserve optionality and tee up an alternative that wouldn't otherwise exist.
Default.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe you answered my question. I'm getting the fact that no utility wants it, and I think that with those comments, we're also indicating that we don't feel that our utilities are capable of managing their current assets. If they have proposed regulations, we typically go and work with them to give them the flexibility to go and meet those changing requirements. So to imply that this is the only option or that our utility friends aren't competent or capable enough to provide the need. It seems like this is a project that's looking for somebody to buy it when nobody wants to purchase it. And I'm just trying to understand. I mean, this is a project that's been on the books, been given special exemptions for many years. Do you know of any other projects, any other technologies that are given these types of eminent domain authority?
Representative Beard. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, actually, I do. They're called renewables. If you get down to the MISO board or down to Nicollet Avenue to the XL Energy Dispatch Center, and you watch their power board, when the wind comes up, we require them by regulation to buy the wind first. And then all their other assets get dialed back so that we buy the wind. So I can think of one right off the top of my head. In fact, I think the next couple of bills will probably be addressing some transparency and just what that's costing the system and every ratepayer that's out there, because we have managed the utility's assets in this case, their generation, and told them that when the wind blows, you'll dial your generation back and you'll buy the wind. Furthermore, to the thing about who's going to buy this power, at this moment, no one. I'm thinking of another gas plant, 750 megawatts, I think, up in Chisago County that was toyed with a couple of years ago, and I think that they were a merchant, a generating merchant company that came into town and proposed 750 megawatts to put on the grid, and no one's heard of that that endeavor since. However, I would like to point out that in this current economic slump that we're in, where actual demand for baseload power, Representative Falk, is actually heading the other way, this will not continue forever. Hopefully, optimists that we are, the economy will turn around, demand will grow, and I think that the whole process that this Excelsior project has gone through over the last, actually 8 years since I first carried the bill, is illustrative of the problem we're going to have in trying to catch up with baseload power. This project, excuse me, members, hit the ground running with a certificate of need and transmission siting granted. So they had a several-year head start on any other baseload plant that's out there. We watched what the PUC and the environmentalist groups did to the coalition of industry that was trying to rebuild the Big Stone 2 project. Eventually, under the weight of the regulatory and legal assault, that thing collapsed after $50 million ratepayer dollars were expended to try to just prove the case for Big Stone. So to have this one struggle for 8 years, even after the legislature gave it a leg up to demonstrate an innovative energy generating technique, I think illustrates the point that whenever we do get into a growth curve again, and I'm optimistic that we will, it's not unreasonable to expect maybe 15 years of regulatory assault in a minefield that the environmental special interest groups are going to make us walk through to try to get any baseload power built. And I might add that we have done the reverse of a mandate. We've actually prohibited coal generation and nuclear generation in this state. So the only thing we have left are the energy sources that we've mandated that the utilities buy when the sun shines and when the wind blows. So I appreciate the question because it gives us a chance to talk about a broad range of problems that we've afflicted the utilities with, and I appreciate your concern about their ability to manage their assets on behalf of the ratepayers.
Representative Paul. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I kindly asked Mr. Eliff if he'd let me to use the book here, but the part I was asking about is if there are any other private companies that have this level of eminent domain actually here in 216B 1694 Subdivision 2 Regulatory Incentives, Paragraph 3, for if you have an innovative energy project, has the power of eminent domain, which shall be limited to the sites and routes approved by the Environmental Quality Board for these projects, facilities. Project shall be considered utilities defined in Section 216E.01, Subdivision 10, for the limited purpose of 216E.12. Project shall report any intent to exercise eminent domain authority to the board. I still don't know if there's any other entity that we have, private entity, that we have granted eminent domain authority to in statute.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
I'm concerned when you give a private entity with the profit driving motive that much authority. Now, utilities have to actually provide a service. They are allowed to be profit driving, but they have the requirement to provide that public service and public need. This is a private entity that wants to go and forcibly sell energy to a utility as a private as a profit driving mechanism.
Representative Beard. Actually, Representative Falk made most of my points. private utilities do have eminent domain assessments. Certificate of need and siting and transmission corridors have been identified, just the same as we gave Excelsior. Once the PUC approves the power purchase agreement and the siting and everything else, you mentioned the word force. When the bill was first brought to me in 2003, it had a mandate that required energy companies to buy this merchant power. I told them that I would not carry, I don't do mandates on this, and that I would not carry the bill with a mandate in there. So we stripped the mandate language out. So I think the PUC saw that clearly when they declined to force anybody to buy power from the project. They made the least cost alternative process and so on and so forth. So forced is not an accurate word. I just wanted to talk about that.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard, I'm just curious. There's a number of projects proposed on the Iron Range and some of them under construction, expansions, the Keetac, the Polymet, different, the steel plant. How do all those fit? It seems like potentially as these all move forward, do we currently up there have all the base load for all these different projects?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if we can get past the static, actually, that would be a question for our friends at Minnesota Power. I believe that when all of them come online, they'll be using everything, they'll be spinning everything they can spin and burning everything they can burn, including the power or the wind farms that they're buying and building in North Dakota to make that work. Could there be dispatchable merchant power put onto the grid that they would also access? I believe it's possible. Again, I refuse to mandate that Minnesota Power buy electricity from this project, but I think it would be very helpful in a couple of years to have that there for backup, particularly for the times when the wind is not blowing in North Dakota and they're still trying to roast taconite or mine their polymet or create iron nuggets or whatever else they're doing, which are very, very electric energy intensive processes. So,
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm wondering, Representative Beard, don't we require analysis or kind of plan ahead so all of a sudden the lights don't dim? Do we have an analysis out there with all these potentially coming on? And they've been delayed, some of them, but at some point we anticipate hopefully they're going to move forward. I'm wondering, does someone from the agency or Minnesota Power have feelings? It seems like why wouldn't we want to have some options open? It would really be unfortunate, I think, as we move forward and all of a sudden we find out, no, now we've got the permits, but we have to stop because we don't have the power to run the plants, and it takes 5 years to get a permit. This permitting process works so long. Why wouldn't we want this moving forward as another option?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's the reason I brought the bill forward, was to give us options going forward into the future. Every regulated utility has to have what's called an integrated resource plan. At this moment, off the top of my head, I don't know what Minnesota Power's is, and I think it would be unfair at a moment's notice to call them down here and ask them what it is. But as the bill comes back, if it's included in the omnibus bill, we certainly could have that information and talk about that.
All right, let's move on. Commissioner Grant.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the committee. Just state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Again, Bill Grant from the Department of Commerce, Office of Energy Security. We have several issues, and just by way of background, since the law was passed granting the special exemptions that we've discussed, the authority for siting and routing and the staff that goes with that was transferred from the Environmental Quality Board to our office, and Deb Pyle is with me. She manages the unit, the Energy Facilities Permitting Unit, that actually worked on this project, and she's available to answer some questions if you have them after I testify. A fundamental concern with the proposal at this point is that the entire permitting process that this project went through was premised on the notion that it was going to be a coal feedstock integrated gasification combined cycle power plant, and proposed pursuant to 216B1694. The joint state-federal environmental impact statement also was premised on IGCC and clean coal. Since Mesaba was selected by the U.S. Department of Energy under a clean coal power initiative. Thus, the state, the joint state-federal EIS excluded consideration of things like alternative sites outside the taconite relief area or issues related to need, size, and type that would normally be considered. Second issue is that this project proposes gas as a primary fuel, which we presume means that there will be a backup fuel, most likely fuel oil. This was not evaluated in the EIS or covered in the site permit. Our most significant concern is with the language that states that the site and route permits would be valid for 4 years after the last state or federal permit is issued, regardless of when Mesaba might apply for those other permits. Commission permits normally allow 4 years from issuance to commence construction, or the commission then considers suspension. So the permits were issued on March 12, 2010, and 4 years would bring it to March 12, 2014. We feel that a better approach would be for Mesaba to request an amendment when they need one, rather than having an open-ended four-year authority. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the proposed changes would seem to imply that any gas plant proposed for the taconite relief area would be exempt from the requirements of certificate of need rather than limiting that authority to this project, which I think was the intent.
Questions, Commissioner Grant? Okay, seeing none, thank you. We'll move on to Linda Taylor, Fresh Energy. Welcome to the committee. State your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. my name is Linda Taylor. I'm the, Clean Energy Director at Fresh Energy. House File 618, the Delete Everything Amendment, grants to a relatively generic natural gas power plant some of the remarkable special advantages that were granted to the IGCC proposal earlier on. That proposal actually was at some point looking at integrating what really would have been innovative, which would have been carbon capture and sequestration. The advantages that were granted in the 2003 legislation are in fact extraordinary. The ones that carry over to the plant as a standalone gas plant, first, the electricity generated by the plant doesn't have to have a market. There doesn't need to be any finding of need for the power from this plant. Certificates of need and integrated resource planning are generally required to ensure deliberate and carefully planned electricity capacity additions statewide. The legislature enacted certificate of need and integrated resource planning requirements after the last round of really lumpy and fractured capacity additions in the 1970s and 1980s. Because of the uneven timing of those additions during that time, not only did we have lots of excess capacity in the system that we had to pay for, but we also had seriously disparate rates between neighboring utilities. The point of certificate of need and integrated resource planning was to smooth that process out so that over a 15-year period, we were always looking out, looking at what demand forecasts are, looking at what kind of capacity additions need to be made, et cetera, so that we can move deliberately forward in a planning sense. Ratepayers pay for electricity capacity. They pay for it whether they can use it or not. And they pay for it either as ratepayers or they pay for it as taxpayers when it is planned and not built. An exception to the fact that there is very little private financial risk taken when developing power systems and power plants, an exception to that, especially recently, has been the development of natural gas plants. There's actually a competitive market for natural gas plants. The second extraordinary advantage that this plant gets is that it can increase its output in the future without any further regulatory approvals. In addition, all approvals and permits granted shift to the gas plant without any further review for what the differences might be, including backup fuel and other issues. And finally, all further public permits have to be granted without any further public participation or any ability to take a review those permitting processes. The third thing is the grant of eminent domain. Granting a private independent power producer eminent domain is simply anti-competitive. In general, one of the few portions of the power sector in Minnesota that involves substantial private competition is in the independent power producing sector. Independent power producers compete by taking actual private risk. They compete over finding the best locations and customers for their power, and they compete on price. Mandating this specific gas power plant when a number of other companies are ready and willing to compete in the market is anti-competitive and shifts more financial risks than necessary onto ratepayers. The inescapable conclusion is that this plant cannot compete in the market. That immediately translates into higher prices for ratepayers. If there were good reasons to grant these advantages to an innovative coal plant when there were no competitors in the market, they simply do not apply to a gas plant when there are numerous market competitors. That competition, allowed to freely operate, will best serve the interests of the electricity sector and ratepayers in particular. We request that you do not include this bill in the potential omnibus energy bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Members? Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Next would be atmosphere recovery. Ronald Rich. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. My name is Ronald Rich. I actually just represent myself as a concerned citizen, but I am president of Atmosphere Recovery. I make equipment that controls and operates, measures advanced technology from alternative energy to conventional energy, as well as other industrial processes. So I'm coming here trying to be a technical expert as a concerned citizen, trying to remove the politics, which is so convoluted I can't understand it, to come to a point where I have no clue why, as a taxpayer, I'm trying to fund something that has no value in terms of an advancing of an innovative energy or the possibility of converting to clean coal or carbon capture and sequestration. This plant is, if I'm going to go back a little bit, the problem that has been stated now is that we're now from a coal plant that couldn't carbon capture but had the potential to carbon capture down to a plant now that is going to have natural gas somehow, not specified, but somehow, someday, could be converted to a coal plant, which somehow, someday, could be converted to a carbon capture and sequestration facility. I apologize for my voice. I've got a little problem with my throat. So the problem that I'm having with this is it's gone backwards to a point where we're now at 1975 and before technology or even before that. And I want to make sure that people understand technically, I'm going to remove my opinions, technically what's being proposed is essentially a jet engine and a little gearbox, and it runs a generator, and it burns natural gas. Well, the jet engine will not be designed to take coal gasification type syngas because it takes too much more capacity. It costs too much. This power has to be cost competitive, or they're not going to sell it. They won't build it that way. They'll build it with a conventional technology. It will not be upgradable to coal facilities with syngas unless they spend an inordinate amount of additional funds at the beginning that just makes that plant uneconomic. They also don't have the steam capture necessarily. As far as I can see in the bill, they could build what's called a peaking plant, just a jet engine with a little turbine. Companies build those all the time. They run up and down and hold power constant throughout the grid when there's down times for other power, and it's mostly used in the summer. There's no requirement in here for them to build something that is upgradable. There's no requirement for them to build anything that has a potential to capture carbon. There is no value in this plan as an advanced alternative project. It just seems to be a political way of continuing this company's, I would assume, proposals that have failed. And IGCC in general and carbon capture and sequestration has always been an issue with the fossil fuel lobbyists and promoting and pushing energy sources and technologies that don't exist. And none of these technologies really exist. There really is no such thing as clean coal. There is such a thing as a natural gas plant, but it doesn't deserve my taxpayer funding and a lot of other special kinds of considerations that this bill provides. What I'm trying to recommend is that you terminate this kind of a bill, remove it from the Omnibus Energy Bill. Please don't consider something. This is so far from the original goal. It's so non-innovative that it spoils the other ability for other companies to put in alternative energy or other gas facilities. And I'd be happy to take questions on the technology portion, because you've been hearing many, many things that are just simply glossed over or not true. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Rich? Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I had a question for Representative Beard and a couple of previous testifiers, if people are done with this testifier.
Okay, we have one more testifier, and then thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
XL Energy, Rick Evans. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. I wanted to just make a point that's a little different from some of the points the others have made in testimony. As you've heard, this bill was this law was originally passed in 2003. In that law, certain benefits were given to this project in order to encourage the coal gasification technology that they promote. Among the provisions that were included in that law was one that said that if it meets certain requirements, this project would be, and I'm reading from the statute now, shall be entitled to enter into a contract with a public utility that owns a nuclear generation facility in the state to provide 450 megawatts of baseload capacity. That, of course, is XL Energy. We're the only nuclear utility in the state. Now, that requirement to enter, or that entitlement to enter into a contract, is subject to a lot of conditions. It has to be approved by the PUC. In fact, it's been to the PUC once and was not approved. But that provision is still present on the books. Now, under this amendment, that provision would still only apply if this became a coal plant. So we're gratified that they're not expanding this requirement that we enter into a contract with them for a gas plant. We have plenty of gas plants. We build them all the time, and so we wouldn't want to be required to purchase this particular gas plant. But I think for the reasons that Ms. Jorgensen outlined, things have changed a lot in the last 8 years since this bill was passed, and we expect that before this thing were to ever become a coal plant sometime in the future, things would change again. And while we are in the process under this bill of reevaluating and refiguring the benefits that are going to go to this project, we think it's appropriate to revisit all of the benefits that were granted in 2003. And so we look forward to working with Representative Beard and the proponents on the bill as it moves forward to see if we can't work on all of the benefits that were provided in the bill, to make sure that we're setting the state policy towards this project correctly today. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Mr. Evans, so is it XL Energy's current position that they do not have a need or wish to purchase power from this facility, just to get that on the record?
Yes, that's correct, Representative Paul, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way the statute reads, you said that it's, if you could just explain it a little more, that the the plant would be entitled to sell X energy savings, 2 megawatts, if it's a coal plant. Is that, does that matter if it's a coal plant, the carbon is captured or captured? And then if Xcel would be required to buy that energy, what impact might that have on your resource plan going? I know Xcel has a carbon neutral plan going forward, and you know, is looking out to see the likely regulation on greenhouse gas emissions in the next number of years. And so I just want a little more clarification on that point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth, I think I need to defer to someone else. I don't believe that the obligation or the I want to make sure I get the words right. The entitlement to enter into a contract with us is conditioned on carbon sequestration. As I look at the way the Innovative Energy Project is defined, I don't believe that that's a requirement. But someone else could have, you know, looked through other parts of the law, and I may be wrong about that. The second part of your question, as far as our resource planning is concerned, one of the important conditions that's placed on this provision that this project is entitled to a contract is that it has to be approved by the Public Utilities Commission. And so that's an extremely important protection, because I don't, you know, our hope is the Public Utilities Commission is not going to require us to buy energy that we don't need, and is not going to require us to buy energy at an uncompetitive price. And so, but having said that, still having this requirement on statute that we purchase this creates a fair amount of uncertainty as to exactly what our obligations are and what our requirements are going forward. So it does enter into our planning. It is an obligation that we file with the SEC, for example, every year to allow our shareholders to know, or our potential shareholders to know, that we have this obligation out there. You know, I would have to say that there's probably some controversy about what this provision even means as it was adopted in 2003, but you know, our comfort is that the Public Utilities Commission ultimately has to approve any contract that's presented by the proponents of this plant, and our hope is that they would not require us to purchase energy that we don't need, or energy that's too expensive.
Any additional questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Evans. Representative Falk, did you have a question for Representative Beard?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard, how many dollars in public money has this project received thus far?
Mr. Beard, there have been no tax dollars put into this from the state level. However, I do have a list of the things that they've applied for and received. Some people have made a point that they're entitled to money from the Renewable Development Fund. They were entitled to apply to the RDF as an innovative energy resource for funding. That yielded $10 million in ratepayer dollars that the legislature mandates Xcel Energy put into the RDF every year. That was $2 million for five years. The IRRRB put in $9.5 million from their resources, which we had a long discussion on the floor the other day about where those dollars come from. The federal government, through the Department of Energy, has granted $133 million in federal investment tax credits, not actual cash, to the project itself, but to folks around it to take tax credits totaling $133 million. And there have been federally authorized loan guarantees, which to my knowledge haven't been put in play yet, because there's been no money loaned to the project, because there is no market for the they haven't been able to secure a power purchase agreement to sell electricity yet. But that's what I know about, and if the folks from Xcelsior Energy know of more, I'd be happy to have them come back and shed a little more light on it. But that's what I can tell you. To be clear, no taxpayer dollars and no ratepayer dollars to this point.
Representative Faulkner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Beard, I guess I would contend that, I mean, the money had to come from somewhere. Some of it was TACNET relief money or TACNET development money. But the other Renewable Energy Development Fund, I don't think that was necessarily, they may have applied, but it was mandated in statute that money, that they get $2 million a year for 5 years to this project. And so I think that was given a quite uneven playing field when you have to compete against all the other applicants that are applying for those resources. Now, granted, this happened before I was here, but just looking at the history of it, it seems like that's quite generous, and specifically when we had the legislative auditor's report really questioning whether or not this meant the needs of what we consider to be renewable energy development. I think that there is some concern there. And I have no issue with making the fact that I don't particularly like this project. I don't think it serves a need that's beneficial or useful, and I think that it's gotten far and away too much public dollar. I mean, it's depending, you may say it doesn't come from taxpayers, but we do appropriate it or we do administer it through public sources, and so essentially I do consider it to be public dollars, and it's just a project that I think is really does not stand on its own merits.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if Ms. Jorgensen could come back to the this table for a moment.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jorgensen, I just wanted to clarify a couple things. First of all, I believe initially there were three site proposals for this project. And I believe according to the amendment that we adopted, any one of those would still be a viable site for your project. Is that correct?
Jorgensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, we actually went through a very lengthy site selection process with the Citizens Advisory Board participating and narrowed our current analysis down to two sites, one on the West Range near Bovee and the other on the East Range. And the West Range site was identified by through the Department of Energy process and the PUC siting process as the preferred and then designated site. And then the alternative site is also was deemed adequate to support a project of this nature.
Representative Hilty.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Jorgensen, does that mean that currently there are only two innovative project sites that exist? And
Ms. Jorgensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, that's correct. At this point, there are two designated sites that are innovative energy project sites.
Representative Hilty.
So, Mr. Chair, would that mean then, maybe this is a question for Representative Beard, I think Director Grant raised the question of the possibility of some other project entirely being covered with this amendment that could occupy an innovative energy site. Is that the case?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, no, I don't think that's the intent. To be clear, though, part of our power plant siting process is that when a utility or anyone wants to propose a power plant location, they're required to actually do two complete EISs and go through that whole thing just for further discussion someday. So the two sites were identified by Excelsior, and it was narrowed down. I think that the best site was on the west end of the range. However, they both were identified as those sites. As I understand the bill that I've been asked to carry here, this would be to take, I believe, either of those sites could start out as the gas plant then and then later on bridge to coal gasification.
Well, so
just
Chair,
on those two sites.
Mr. Chair, I understand that, but Representative Beard, the delete all amendment states, a plant that proposes to use natural gas as a primary fuel and is located on a site designated as an innovative energy project site. So I understand that your intention is that this would apply to Ms. Jorgensen's project, but my question is, would it apply to any other proposed project as well?
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, perhaps I could have Ms. Jorgensen speak to that, because I'm understanding there's only possibly two, and we were leaning towards one, but apparently the statutes say that there could be up to three, and I'm not clear as to how that is. So either Mr. Eloff or Ms. Jorgensen could speak to that much more clearly than I could.
Well, Ms. Jorgensen?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify,
sure.
The question is not about Ms. Jorgensen's project. It is about the possibility of some other project being included here, because what your bill states is that these conditions apply to a plant that proposes to use natural gas as a primary fuel. So if someone else had a proposal, would they also be covered by this bill?
Mr. Eloff, can you clarify what the amendment says and how it pertains to this project as opposed to maybe somebody else wanting to do this?
I can try, Mr. Chair. As Representative Hilty mentioned, the bill says that any plant that proposes to use natural gas as a primary fuel and is located on a site designated as an innovative energy project under Subdivision 1 of this section is accorded those three regulatory incentives. My understanding is that Ms. Jorgensen told us that two sites have been designated that fit that description. Therefore, it seems to me that up to two projects could be accorded these regulatory incentives.
Well, thank you, Mr. Eloff and Representative Beard. If we need some clarifying language to make it pertain to this project and this project only, then maybe we can bring that forward before we move on with the bill. As we are holding this bill over for possible inclusion, so we do have time to clarify that.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hilty, for calling that to our attention, because that is not...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you. Ms. Jorgensen.
Representative Hilty?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Jorgensen, I did have another question. Just to clarify so that everybody understands where we're at, including me. At this point, there has been no shovel in the ground anywhere. Nothing has been built, or materials have not even been accumulated to begin building a project anywhere. Is that correct?
Jorgensen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, that's correct until the final permits are issued and we identify a customer. No shovels will be stuck into the ground, I guess.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Jorgensen, just to make that absolutely clear, could you describe for the committee what the circumstances would have to be before a shovel got stuck in the ground?
Ms. Jorgensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, at this point, with the final EIS being issued, the transmission interconnection agreement being signed, the water appropriation is in place, the sites and routes have been approved for all the necessary infrastructure. What remains is the issuance of the remaining state permits that flow logically from the EIS analysis that's been done. There are four large permits that have yet to be issued. And then there's been a lot of talk about imposing costs and competition, and the bottom line is, on the question of need, we're not proposing to build a merchant plant. If a customer isn't identified, the plant will not be built. That's plain and simple. And so that's what we're proposing here is not to tie up those last pieces, but to lay out a plan to get the site to where it's ready so that when demand develops and a customer wants to buy the power, that we have resources available to meet that need.
So, Hilty?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Jorgensen, would it be fair to say that at this point what you're intending is to keep the options open so that if one or more of the major projects, mining projects that are being proposed or under consideration, on the range develops, that you would hope to be able to satisfy the power needs for that project?
Jorgensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, that's correct. And in addition, if utilities, I think, are still required under state law to seek to go out for a competitive bid for proposals to serve their load, I would quarrel with the notion that the state of Minnesota is teeming with independent power producers teeing up competitive alternatives. The fact of the matter is that while in many other states there is a competitive wholesale market, meaning the generation is bid out by the utilities. Of course, they still keep the monopoly to serve their retail customers. It's been shown, you know, at the national level that having a robust wholesale market where competitive power companies such as ours actually develop these alternatives in advance of load developing and then can bid into PUC overseen bidding process actually leads to more competitive power rates, not less competitive power rates. And I believe that just our mere existence over the last 10 years has required that the utilities sharpen their pencils and think more creatively and bring better ideas to the table, frankly. But the notion that we are being given a special leg up over, you know, these scores of power plant developers that are proposing natural gas-fired generation in the state, sadly, that's not the case as it is in other states where that wholesale market is robust and leading to more competitive power supply.
Members, we've got two more bills to get through today, and if we don't get them done before 10 o'clock, we're going to have to come back here at 4:30. So I was hoping we could get everything wrapped up here this morning, but hopefully we can still do that. Let's try to move forward. Representative Hilty, did you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Representative Beard could do this, or I'm not sure who the best person is, but looking at lines 1.10 to 1.19, could you explain to me, this language is kind of not, it's a little difficult to follow, and my sense is if a project has already been through a contested case hearing, then the permits can't be used in a contested case. Could you just explain this to me a little bit more? What I want to be sure is that we're not getting permits put out there and then not having any way, either through the administrative law judge or a contested case hearing, to actually have the general public discuss them. So if maybe Mr. Iliff could explain it.
Mr. Chairman, there was a contested case, and this is referring specifically to the power purchase agreement that they were entitled to negotiate with Xcel Energy. But perhaps Mr. Osterhaus kind of directed that whole thing. Could we have him explain it concisely?
Absolutely, Mr. Osterhaus.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. There would still be opportunity for public comment because the agencies would have to process the permit application, and they always take public comment, and there could be hearings. What this language is saying is that there would not be a formal contested case before an ALJ in circumstances where that had already occurred as part of the broader EIS review. And, of course, nothing here changes the requirements of federal law, which still allow for, since Minnesota's a delegated state, under federal law, there are still reviews at the federal level that would be available.
Representative Knuth.
Okay, so could you explain thank you, Mr. Chair, explain the purpose of this language?
Thank you, Chair, Representative Knuth. The purpose of this language is to avoid duplication of effort. That we went through 5 years of contested case hearings. We took over 700 comments, and they were all addressed. And so the notion here is, having done that, there's no need to repeat that process as we process the individual air or water permits.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple other questions, but on this line here, you say that the purpose is to avoid duplication. Well, duplicative of what? I mean, this is a different project in the sense that you're changing it from a integrated coal carbon capture project to a just very standard run-of-the-mill natural gas plant. So obviously these things are different, so why shouldn't the public be allowed to go and have their comments heard, and why shouldn't they be allowed to go and raise issues? Because you are dealing with something very different than what was originally proposed. Tell me how it's not different.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. To be clear, the waiver of contested case hearings, if you'll note, applies to the Innovative Energy Project, which is still defined as the coal gasification project. So in other words, the gas permitting would go as any gas plant permitting would go, and that this provision refers to the integrated coal facility. Thank you.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'm not understanding this language correctly, but it says a plant that proposes to use natural gas as a primary fuel and is located on a site designated as an innovative energy project under project site under Subdivision 1, Clause 3. So you're telling me that this natural gas plant built on an innovative energy site is actually a coal plant that captures carbon? That's what you're giving the exemptions to? Is
no. Mr. Chair, Representative, with respect, I don't think that's what it says.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how is this not a separate project? I mean, you're using different technology. Sure, it's using the same site, but you're really changing what is being proposed in the middle of the process here. So why doesn't the process restart? Why doesn't it, when you're using a different technology and you're essentially serving a different, you know, possibly a different purpose, how come it's not a new project?
Mr. Chair, Representative, with respect to the staged gas facility that would go into place in advance of conversion to later operation on coal, it would be a standalone permitting effort of that gas plant that would not be subject to what's listed here in the proposed subdivision B2. Subdivision B2 is referring to the Innovative Energy Project, which remains the coal gasification project. And that's the project that was the subject of the contested case in the EIS. So if you were to go forward with the staging, you would simply go and get permits for the gas plant, separate and apart from the permitting process for the integrated gasification facility.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baird, I just want to clarify, if you would clarify for me, in response to a question from Representative Walk, you talked about IRRP funds that went into this project, but no taxpayer dollars, and I had that turned around, but it's not a quote. But, and I just wanted to clarify, and you referred to some of our discussion on the House floor regarding the IRRB here last week, and but to clarify then that we're saying that IRRB funds, at least that went into this project, are not taxpayer dollars.
Representative Beard, Mr. I don't Chairman. Think that's what you said.
Mr. Chairman, what I said was the funding sources on the range that are a mystery to me. We were just talking about the Doug Johnson Fund, the IRRB Fund, and several other things that have to do with taconite severance taxes and payments up there in lieu of property taxes that go to these several funds. From one of those funds, the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, we used to call it IRRB. I don't know what we call it this year. But anyhow, they made loans to this company, or grants, actually, I believe, to this company. And so to the extent that they're not general fund dollars or real estate taxes, yeah, you could parse that word. But did they come from taxes that somebody paid into that fund? Yes, they did. And they came through the IRRB.
Representative Purcell.
And because if I remember the discussion on the floor, there was some argument that that some of these funds were, and I admit I don't know the ideology of a lot of those funding, but certainly the argument was made that some of this might be taxpayer general fund dollars, and I don't know that I accept that, but just wanted your clarification. Thank you.
Noted. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not quite sure who this question is for, but if memory serves correctly, this original project was given the right of eminent domain, which was very different because usually private corporations are not given the right of eminent domain. Do those rights still rest with the company? And I mean, if I remember correctly, it was to bring in power plants through the northern suburb, I mean power lines through the northern suburbs into Minneapolis. Does the company still have those rights, or have they been taken away in some legislation or in this amendment?
Representative Beard. Mr. Chairman, the amendments or the legislation we had last year that trimmed the ability of public utilities to use eminent domain, I don't believe affected this process, because it had already, the site, the route, and everything had already been issued. And to be clear, as I understand the bill that I'm bringing forward here,
everything that was granted in the innovative energy package from 2003 is still here. All this does is allow them to start the project with a natural gas fired generation plant to bridge them to the day when they can actually get the final permits and everything and financing primarily to do the coal gasification. So everything stays with the project as it was put together in 2003. That's my understanding.
Representative Wagenius.
So then all of the folks who have brought up the property rights issues have not had a measurable impact on this project.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, I believe that would be accurate. Going forward, anything going forward that's permitted, yes, they have had a big impact on that. This one was kept intact.
Any additional questions? Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this is the question I want to ask Ms. Jurgensen. So notwithstanding the potential federal dollars, but the money that's been appropriated through the state, the RDF money and the IRRB money, what has it been spent on?
Jurgensen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the budget to develop a baseload power plant to this stage of development is basically typical of what's required in the industry. When you look at the Big Stone plant, Representative Beard mentioned that they got not to this stage of development, but they expended $50 million. What that money goes towards, in a larger proportion of the budget than what would typically be expected, goes towards the environmental permitting, this seven-year process, you know, where you end up with literally a room full of technical analysis that you repeat because the protocols change, you model it again. The engineering work that has to be done to answer the questions in the process, the questions that need to be responded to. So basically, the bulk of the funds have gone towards that permitting process and the effort at the Public Utilities Commission. There's been a significant amount of engineering work undertaken for us to figure out what our permit limits can be, what we can live with from an engineering standpoint, to get to those fine points where we can say, yeah, we control virtually all the mercury in the plant. So really that's the bulk of the expenditures have gone towards engineering and the permitting and regulatory processes both at the state and the federal level.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you said the bulk of it goes towards engineering and permitting, I understand that, but typically with projects of this complexity, you'd have to have somebody to actually manage the project. And has that function also been done internally, externally? Has that been a function that has got to be able to be paid for the work that they've, that whoever's done that has done? Can you, I mean, because somebody has to put all these parts together.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, we also have had a team of engineers that have been working both on the permitting and the engineering, overseeing consultants. I mean, it takes the leadership of a development company, obviously, is what your point is, to pull the pull all the components together, decide which consultants need to be hired to satisfy the different agency requirements. So we've tapped the expertise of external engineers such as Fluor, General Electric, ConocoPhillips. We have a license of the ConocoPhillips technology, and they've been our development partner throughout the process. But yeah, the orchestration has been overseen by our internal team.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I mean that at least $19.5 million buys you quite a lot. How much private capital has been put at risk here?
Jurgensen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are a private company. We don't disclose our financials publicly. I can say that there there is a private commitment, private investments, both in cash and in kind, in the tens of millions of dollars that don't show up, obviously, in our cash budget that we're talking about.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Jorgensen, I understand that the private company don't have to disclose these things, but when we are investing this much public money, I think that transparency is warranted. And, I mean, sure, we can say that in-kind contributions can total huge sums, but once again, there's no auditing, there's no verification, there's no documentation to support those claims. And so I see this as just a huge sum of corporate welfare, where we're giving away vast dollars of public resources to one particular project. How is that warranted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, I guess my preferential way of describing this is that it's a public, private, state, and federal partnership. It is true that significant public dollars have been invested. On the accountability front, I can say that we've been subjected, you know, to an audit. Iron Range Resources was subjected to an audit. We're subject to audit by the U.S. Department of Defense because we're a federal contractor with the U.S. Department of Energy. So every single entry we make, every single expenditure we make has been scrutinized. In the case of the Excel fund, Excel itself reviewed the expenditures and knew what they were. So from our perspective, we are accounting to those stakeholders through those mechanisms.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Falk, we do need to move on to some other bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, like I say, if all the documentation exists and it's been looked over by all those entities, but this project is still coming before the legislature, why is it inherent that we don't, or the public doesn't get to see that? Because you're asking for the public approval, you're asking for public resources, you're asking for the public ability to allow this project to go forward. I think that transparency is important. Mm-hmm. This is a public institution.
Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to sum up here, I'm really gratified to hear the concern for public transparency and accountability. Perhaps the next two bills coming up about ratepayer protection and the impact of the renewable energy standard will generate the same kind of enthusiasm. I would like to just clarify that this bill asks the taxpayers for no money. There's no impact to the ratepayers or the taxpayers. This merely moves the permitting process and four years down the road, actually 3 more years down the road now, and allows them to start, if they can arrange for a market-based power purchase agreement. That's key, because no construction will start until they have a free market contract they've entered into. And then, if that happens, we're asking, we the public, public's representatives are being asked to grant them authority and permission to start with a natural gas plant instead of the whole coal gasification process. That's pretty much the sum total of the bill, Mr. Chairman. So with that, I'd ask that we lay it over for possible inclusion and obviously some more discussion and maybe another amendment before we get to inclusion if we do that.
Thank you very much, Representative Beard. We'll hold over House File 618 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Energy Bill. Representative Hancock, House File 220. Representative Scott had to go to another committee. We'll have to take up her bill at another time, the House File 1375. So hopefully we can wrap up your bill, Representative Hancock. Please
Thank you,
proceed.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 220. And I do also like to move that to the
Representative Hancock. Representative Hancock moves House File 220 to be possibly included in the Energy Omnibus Bill, and he also moves the
A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment to get it in the shape that he'd like. And all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Two-year bill as amended, Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. What this bill does, I believe, is returns the original intent of the 2007 renewable energy standard that exempted hydropower from being counted in the total retail sales. And I believe it is also consistent in that it treats customers served by either a direct distribution co-op or a G&T generation and transmission entity on an equal basis. And I think what that does is it, like I said, goes back to the original intent, and it levels the playing field when it comes to the use of hydropower in the renewable energy standard.
Very good. We'll move on to testifiers. Josh Gackle, Wind on the Wire. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Josh Gackle, Wind on the Wires. It wasn't that long ago when I was sitting there next to you. It's strange to be on this side of the table. Thank you, committee members. Wind on the Wires is a consortium of wind developers and clean energy groups. We're a nonprofit based in St. Paul. And we work throughout 9 states in the upper Midwest on regulatory and policy burdens to bringing wind power to market. When this bill was up in the Senate Energy Committee a few weeks ago, we testified as well. We have some concerns with the language of the bill and the impact it would have on the renewable energy standard. We understand from the bill proponents that they view it as a technical change to what was agreed to in 2007 when the RES was first passed. We think it does a little bit more than that, and that it materially affects the renewable energy standard, reducing the 25% obligation to something less than that. It would, in effect, from the numbers we've looked at, require about 150 to 200 megawatts less of new wind being constructed in Minnesota. And I'll keep my testimony short and just give you a specific example of how that decrease in the amount of new wind construction in Minnesota affects jobs and economic development in Minnesota. Several of you a few weeks ago took the chance to meet with some of our members as they brought in landowners and others to talk about the benefits that they're seeing with the renewable energy standard and wind development in greater Minnesota. We thank you for the time you took to do that. Unfortunately, Representative Hamilton is not on this committee, but one of the latest projects, and it's currently still in construction, will be finished this summer, is in Lakefield, Minnesota, southwest Minnesota. That is a 201-megawatt project being developed by Anexco, one of the developers that are members of Wind on the Wires. That 201-megawatt project is about a $400 million investment in that part of the state. It's going to be about 300 construction jobs during the time of construction, and it's going to lead to 12 to 14 permanent jobs after the project is up and running. In addition, it'll be just shy of $1 million, probably around $800,000 in annual production tax payments to the local government jurisdictions in lieu of property taxes. So these projects do have a tremendous positive effect in the rural communities. And again, we think the bill here, while not directly opposed, we think it may be just a minor, the overall 25%, a minor reduction in the overall 20%, it does lessen the impact, especially the economic and jobs impact of the renewable energy standard in rural Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions, Mr. Gackle? Thank you for your testimony. I'm sorry. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gackle, would you agree that hydropower is renewable energy? Is it as renewable as wind energy?
I don't know if it's as renewable. I would agree that it is renewable, but for the purposes of the renewable energy standard as passed by the legislature in 2007, we don't say hydro is not renewable. We just say for the purpose of the renewable energy standard, which was to incentivize new construction of new renewables, that it doesn't qualify for the purposes of that. But it certainly is a renewable resource.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Gackle, with this being accepted the way it is now, if we do meet our renewable energy standard goals according to our statutes, and it is renewable, I haven't talked to anybody that doesn't believe that hydropower is not renewable. If you add those together at the end, we're going to be above the 25% that the statute requires for renewable energy. Would you say that's accurate?
I haven't looked at the numbers specifically, Representative Drazkowski. If you as far as overall renewable resources, yes, that's likely to be the case. But again, the purpose of the renewable energy standard as passed in 2007, there was a great discussion. There was a long debate both in committee and in, I'm sure, several meetings outside of committee rooms and outside of the House and Senate floor in 2007 on how to count hydro in the renewable energy standard. And again, I believe it was the intent of the legislature at that time and the administration to incentivize new construction of new renewables, not existing hydro, which is renewable, but that was not the purpose of the RES at the time.
Mr. Chair, one
more. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question. Thank you, Mr. Gackle. You know, I'm from a rural area, as well as Representative Hamilton is, and our rural electric co-ops are struggling to deliver low-cost power and meet the renewable energy standard at the same time. You know, do you think it's fair to them to accept or continue to box out this hydropower to the extent that we have been, when if it was included, it would lower their costs and help them better serve their customers?
Well, we think some flexibility for the municipals and co-ops in greater Minnesota, that there are a number of other things going on in the economy right now and with the demand for electricity that are causing some of these hardships to be faced by the rural munis and the rural co-ops. And we see some of those things. You know, there may be ways, again, if it's just this bill and this modification to provide more flexibility, I mean, maybe that's a way to help them get this past this, help the munis and co-ops get past this point. But it's also important to remember that the utilities in general, I don't know that this committee had testimony from them on how they're meeting the RES, but they did testify in front of the Senate Energy Committee early on in session this year, and almost unanimously said they're meeting the renewable energy standard cost effectively, reliably. So it is being, it's not, it doesn't seem to be placing an undue burden on a wide, vast majority of the utilities in the state. So some, but additional flexibility, which this bill may provide in the short term, could be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gackle.
Okay, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gackle, I too am from a rural area. Do you think it was the intent of the legislature in 2007 to raise our electric rates by 85%?
Gackle.
No, Representative, I don't think so. And I think they included language in the bill so that the PUC and other agency officials and the legislature could look at those rate impacts. I know you have another bill, we may not get to it today, that we actually support the transparency and having the utilities report the impact of the renewable energy standard. I would say if the 85% increase in electric rates, if that's the number that some of the rural co-ops are saying it is, the amount of that 85% that's being caused by wind is minuscule.
Any other questions, Mr. Gackle? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we do have to move the minutes from the last meeting. Representative Anderson had a chance to look at the minutes, and he approves the minutes. All in favor of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Next on the list, Lynette Luzma, Beltrami Electric. I hope I pronounced that right. Beltrami Electric. Okay, we'll move on. Linda Taylor, Fresh Energy. Oh, I'm sorry.
We have a sub.
Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lee Sundberg with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, and we represent the 44 distribution co-ops, and of those 44, 12 of the western area distribution co-ops would be involved in this proposed change, and they received the federal hydropower from the Western Area Power Administration, WAPA, and the amount of megawatt hours that are involved here, I think, are, in my view, minimal compared to, or looking at the total amount of megawatt hours that are produced in the state using the OES records of 2009, nearly 61 million megawatt hours produced, or retail sales, this would involve about a factor of 0.0046 that we're talking about that would be involved in this change. Again, it's a relatively small amount for those rural 12 electric co-ops. It's important, but in the overall big picture of things, we're talking a minimal amount, in my view. This was the understanding. Maybe some disagreed with the understanding in 2007, but this is how the bill went out, that federal hydropower would not count as a retail sale. And we had language to make it very explicit. It was said that that wasn't needed, so I pulled the amendment, dropped the amendment. Silly me. Won't do that again. But it was the thought, that was the understanding, and in the Senate hearing, Senate Counsel verified that understanding. So I think I don't think we're asking too much. We're not opening the floodgates of Manitoba Hydro or asking for any other major changes with the bill. We appreciate your support. Thank you.
Very good. Questions of Mr. Sundberg? I'm sorry, Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sundberg, you said it was something along the lines of 0.0004. I don't know if that was percentage or megawatt.
Less than one half.
What would it be required of those rural electric cooperatives if they wanted to go and invest in, say, a wind turbine each? You said these 12. Would it be a 40-kilowatt machine, a 100-kilowatt machine, 250-kilowatt machine, 500-kilowatt machine, 1-megawatt machine? How much level of investment in actual generating capacity that meets the renewable energy standard would be required to go and offset that 0.004?
Sundberg?
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk. My first thing that comes to mind is that you would need to know what the price of the market would be at that time.
Representative Falk.
You know, if you're saying what it equate to.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Falk.
I'm not talking about the cost aspect. I just want to know generating capacity, because we're talking about 0.004. I don't know what that is relation to as far as kilowatt hours sold. And so taking either a wind turbine or a solar PV facility or some type of other qualified renewable energy generating facility, not looking at dollars, but just looking at generating capacity. We can look at the dollars after that, but we should be comparing apples to apples to figure out what you'd have to do to offset the equivalent generation, or what you'd have to add for generation if you didn't enact this proposed piece of legislation.
Mr. Sundberg.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Falk. Since the megawatt hours, not megawatts, that we could tell that are going to be deducted were 280 some thousand megawatt hours, if that were translated into the 2009 data that we used from the 2011 OES report. And I'm hoping this answers your question. We'd be talking 2,800 megawatt hours. Again, how you translate that into capacity then with the one-third capacity factor. Can't do that off the top of my head.
Well, Ms. Sundberg, maybe you and Representative Falk can get together on this a little later. We're going to move on now and have Linda Taylor, Fresh Energy, come up. We're up against the wall. We want to get out of here. It's 10 o'clock now. We're going to run over our time. Hopefully you can keep it brief, Ms. Taylor.
I will do my best, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, once again, I'm Linda Taylor. I'm the Clean Energy Director at Fresh Energy. House File 220, with the author's amendment, inserts complexity into calculating the renewable energy standard. It seems simple enough on its face. The bill says we're not going to count federal hydropower from WAPA in the base retail sales on which the RES is calculated. We submit that the concept is flawed. Reducing the amount of renewable electricity we expect to be developed, particularly in parts of the state with one of the best wind resources in the world, seems counterproductive. The renewable energy standard was adopted in part to ensure that new renewable electricity is developed to benefit localities in Minnesota that have historically seen too little economic development. WAPA power is sold mostly into those parts of the state. WAPA in the past generated and sold hydropower exclusively from dams built by the federal government decades ago. The only economic development associated with basic WAPA power is an increased demand for coal power to make up for diminished hydro production. Increasingly, the amount of hydropower in WAPA sales fluctuates substantially. For the past decade, WAPA's hydroelectric resources have been drastically affected by drought conditions across along the Missouri River system in Montana and North Dakota. In 2007 and 2008, the hydro dams that supply WAPA power sold into Minnesota were only able to produce half of the power normally produced. WAPA purchased coal power to meet its contractual obligations. In 2009 alone, according to the Lignite Council, 1 million tons of additional coal was burned to replace just the power lost from one dam, the Garrison Dam in North Dakota. After 10 years, hydropower production is back to normal this year, but dry conditions throughout the upper Missouri River system occur regularly and can be expected in the future. The portion of the power WAPA sells into Minnesota that is, in fact, from hydroelectric projects changes dramatically over time and does not appear to be adequately differentiated to allow the OES and the PUC to determine how much federal hydro is actually sold to utilities that are subject to Minnesota's renewable energy standard. The combination of not all WAPA power being hydro and the apparent lack of differentiation between hydro and coal and other power by WAPA makes the RES both a constantly moving target and a very difficult to calculate target. At the very least, utilities that subtract WAPA purchases from their total retail sales must carry the responsibility of certifying that the WAPA power is, in fact, hydropower. The varying proportions of hydro in the mix of what WAPA sells will make it difficult for these utilities to accurately plan for how much renewable electricity they need to meet their RES obligations over time. Whether WAPA can and will differentiate its sales or whether the PUC and OES will have to deem how much is actually hydro in any given year makes this all rather messy. There may be ways to fix this, but this bill does not do that. It needs work. We need a clear understanding of the additional administrative burden at OES and the PUC. We need to know whether WAPA can and will differentiate its power sales. Even then, the RES target will fluctuate, making it hard for utilities to determine just how much renewable energy they need to develop or purchase. We'd be very happy to work with folks to see if we can work this out in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hancock will hold over House Bill 220 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Members, we will not be meeting tonight. Representative Scott's bill will be moved to the Wednesday agenda. Meeting adjourned.